This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, you are listening to Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. It is me, Daisy. Welcome. This is a podcast all about extraordinary people and extraordinary stories. Here we will shine the spotlight on their journeys and hopefully learn something about ourselves and the way that we live our lives from their experiences too. Join me for the next half an hour as we get to know our guest. This episode is all about survival, resilience, and intuition. I think we're going to learn a lot from this guest's past. Tabby Chapman was once a part of the Nexium cult and is here to share her survivor story, give us insight into what life was like growing up, and also speak about her pathway out. We are back with another episode of the Proverbs podcast with me, Daisy. Joining me today is Tabby Chapman. Now, she was once indoctrinated in the Nexium cult and is here today to tell her survivor story and also talk about the work that she is now doing to support and educate others. Hi, Tabby. How are you doing?
Hi, thank you. I'm so honored to be invited to your show. It's like I'm speechless.
No, we are honored. We're so honored to have you. I think this is going to be a great episode. You're a really, really incredible, inspiring person as well. So we're so excited to hear your story and your journey. I know you're doing some incredible stuff as well as of recently. So I'm sure there's been a lot. I know it's been a really long and a really difficult road, which is why I think it's so amazing that you're doing so well. And as I said, you're really giving back and you're teaching a lot through your own difficult experience, which I think it takes a certain type of person to do that. So I must start off by praising you for doing that. I think that's amazing. I wondered if you could start off by briefly explaining what the Nexium cult was for anyone that hasn't seen any of the documentaries or haven't heard of it before.
Absolutely. The Nexium cult was initially it was advertised to us as a personal growth or goal setting organization. So many of us went in there thinking, all right, you know, I could use some personal growth. I got some goals, you know, and for many of us, there was always some kind of barrier that would get in the way of us completing our goals. And to be fair, this is how in these introductory meetings, this is how it was framed. You know, most of us probably weren't really focused on our barriers as much, but in that intro, it was, there's some barriers, you know, and, oh yeah, I guess there are some barriers. So most of us joined to be able to reach goals or, you know, grow beyond certain parts of our, you know, personalities we didn't like or whatever. It started usually with some kind of an intensive or between 5 and 16 day long intensive. It was literally intensive from 9 a.m. till 11, 12 at night. And then if they were able to hook you in, then, you know, they booked you in for their like weekly program and got you, you know, close to one of their centers. And then you just kind of got more brought into more and more trainings and more money spending, if you will.
I think what a lot of people don't realize, I feel, about cults is how, I guess, easy it is to fall into them. I think from the documentaries that I've seen on Nexium and on other cults as well, it seems like their goal at first to draw members in is to prey on vulnerability or insecurity and make you feel as though they're there to help you and they're there to better your life, which it seems like that was your experience with Nexium too.
Yeah, my experience with Nexium started with Allison Mack, who's incarcerated right now. She was someone that I was doing a fan site for. I was fresh out of college and one of my college projects was to like run a community site, and I happened to pick her or pick her fan base to run that site with. And eventually Allison reached out to me to do more of a professional collaboration with our actual website. So yeah, I was brought in by Allison. My first in-person meeting with her, basically she was like, hey, I would love to have you work with me. I am asking everyone who's working for me for them to go through this intensive training. And so it was brought up right away. It was, if you want to work with me, you must take the trainings. Otherwise you're not going to work for me. And so that was sort of what kind of initially edged me in, because I really did want to work with her. Why not? And I trusted her experience with the program. I trusted what she was telling me about how it affected her. And she did even, mention that some people are calling it a cult. So if you Google the internet, whatever, you'll see these articles. So, but I will let you know that I haven't experienced anything weird. And that really stuck with me in terms of her experience. And I did feel like that was a good testimony, if you will. So that's kind of my journey and how I got sucked into that.
Yeah. And what did this training entail?
Oh, it goes all over the gambit. The very first 5 days is a reconstruction of vocabulary and lexicon, essentially. So they kind of state that, and also kind of they start to tear you down in the first 5 days. The reconstruction of vocabulary includes redefining words like good and bad, or trust, redefining judgments. There's a whole bunch of different phrases that get redefined for each module. And they claim that they teach you, they don't teach you what to think, they teach you how to think. But, when you sit back and you observe the process by the very nature of how it goes, they require that ultimately you fall in line with their definition of these words. So they are teaching you, what to think in that respect. But for instance, they said it's important to define words like good and bad outside of religious experiences, because religion is kind of the problem as to why we have so much fighting, right? So they define the word good as building value in the world and creating, and bad as destroying value in the world. And so that they kind of all made sure we were all on the same page with those definitions.
What were its methods of control and manipulation that you either saw or you experienced, Tubby?
Well, initially, right away in that first 5-day intensive, for instance, the level of exhaustion we all have, the level of the lack of proper nutrition, I suppose. They made you go a very long time in between meals. Just that sort of physiological control that they would have. No one felt like they could leave in the intensive to take a walk or anything. And they started to, after the first few days, they started to point out if you were distracted by your hunger or your tiredness, and say, at that point they'd already introduced us to this concept of exploration of meaning, which is a sort of a psychological process. But they would say, maybe you should consider getting an EM over, feeling tired right now. Their kind of, catch-all for that was, if you're feeling tired right now, it's probably because you have an issue in yourself, and it's not because you're really tired. So they just really kind of pushed on that physiological control in order to maintain our attention.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the mental control and manipulation, were there things that they would say or do that would make you feel as though you couldn't leave or you can speak to other people from the outside world about this?
Absolutely. Well, the very first thing that they do, again, it's coming just from this, the whole program is meant to be controlling, but it's so evident in this first 5 days, right? The very first thing they do is make you sign a non-disclosure agreement. And they really press that you if you talk to your friends about it, you're not allowed to reveal any of the content. And this is because this is a very experiential program, and it's important that you will ruin their experience if you deductively tell them about the program as opposed to having them inductively understand the program. So that's what they told us. And of course, most of the things that they told us made a little bit of sense, even if some parts of it didn't make sense, you know, we were like, well, okay, I guess that makes sense. But it really felt often like at least for me, it felt often like I was gagged, you know, like I really wanted to share some of the things that I was excited about. And I, you know, it felt worse that I couldn't share. In fact, we inside the cult, sometimes we use the phrase inside world versus outside world. And that was even part of some of the training. And I remember I was kind of at a recruitment coffee date with, not a date, but a coffee event with my, I think it was my wife at the time. I think we were married then, or at very least we were partnered at the time. And another person. And one of us, my partner or I had made the mistake of saying like, oh, this happens in the outside world. And us having no real like understanding that that phrase is weird for people on the outside world, it made the person run instantly. I mean, she just gathered all of her stuff and left. Wow. So yeah, but as you go further and further into the program, and especially if you become a coach like I had, the manipulative tactics get way more psychological, way more intense. So there's sometimes there's sessions where you're sitting in the middle of the circle and 10 other people are surrounding you, just throwing negative feedback in your way. Just talking about what a terrible person they think you are. That's really directly harmful, you know. Other times there were things where they would withhold pay. Like if you were working for them, they would withhold your pay and until you inductively figured out why, which was really maddening at times because I was already not getting paid market rate because they were, you know, making me pay back some of my intensives through exchange. So sometimes they would just really, oh, we're not going to approve this timesheet because it's not correct. But then they would refuse to say, you know, why isn't it correct? So just kind of these weird gaslighting things that kind of felt, you know, would make you crazy a little bit, you know, make you like, just tell me what you need me to do. You know, like I said, the tactics kind of got worse and worse the further you got in. And some degrees, if there's, you know, let's say that you're even a higher ranking person, but if there's one thing that you feel really, really strong on, then that would create an even stronger set of coercive tactics and manipulative tactics to kind of break you from that, you know?
Just feels like it's all a way of just trying to exert control and power and just strip people of their own freedom of choice, even, you know, stripping people of money and earning a wage is just shocking.
Yep. And it happened all of the time. It happened to everybody. I don't know if there's even one single person who was receiving a paycheck from them that did not have this experience happening. So it happened all the time.
What things were members not allowed to do that were strictly off limits, Tabby?
Things that members were not allowed to do that was strictly off limits. That's a great question. So I was not in DOS, but you know, from what I've heard, there is a lot more limitations for DOS. We, like I said, we were not allowed to talk about the program to anybody else. I don't know about anyone else, but I always felt like I would come back to them. So I always was left with that feeling that somehow they would find out that I did. I know that sounds a little paranoid, but that is the feeling that I got often. And so we weren't allowed to talk about the program. We weren't allowed to eat meat in the center, in what we call the center, at least in Albany headquarters. I don't know about the other centers, but we weren't allowed to have any kind of animal products basically in the centers. We were barely allowed to go into the outside world. When I first arrived, no one was allowed to, like it was kind of an I'm trying to explain this, but it was kind of an unwritten rule that no one was allowed to procreate, that, you know, bringing children into this cruel world would create problems. There were only a handful of children involved in the group. And then at some point, there was an unwritten message that people should start procreating. And all of a sudden, you just see an explosion of children being, you know, created and born. People are allowed to, you know, go and get mates, and all of a sudden you see everyone dating people. There was sort of unwritten in that sense, at least to me. I don't know if there was like literal messages going on from Keith or from anyone higher about it otherwise, but I do know that when I decided to have children, I was given a series of EMs and was told that I would destroy children and, you know, with the issues and stuff like that. So I do know that there's explicit effort in preventing people from doing those things if they didn't feel they needed it.
How many people would you say were in NXTium, Tabby, and how long did they typically stay within the cult?
So I know that about 18,000 people in general went through the program. They had several levels of programs, and part of that was also done in Mexico. A lot of people were going through the programs in Mexico. By the time I arrived, I think I've number, my student ID number is like number 7,000 something. Within about a year of my arrival, we had already gotten to between 10 and 12,000 members. So it did kind of slow down after I had left when I got up to 18,000 people. But in order to have a center, you had to have at least 100 active members. So there's members who are coming to your programs or your events all the time on a regular basis. So that is how centers were established. So even though there was 18,000 people that went through it, well, many of them were just like, oh, okay, not for me, and then moved on. You know, but some of them were more identified and as people who they wanted to bring into the fold. And then they were sort of groomed into the process. So for instance, I was groomed into it. I was promised that I could run an a cappella group. And so I was told that I would be taken, you know, be allowed to move over to Albany and have my own little a cappella group, which I thought would be really fun and cool. And I loved singing, but that it didn't quite work out exactly like that, obviously. I was also promised a lot of work that was didn't come through in the end, but at least not in the way that they promised it.
I feel like you've touched on this just a little bit through speaking about your own experience, Tabby, but what was NXTium's view of women and how were women treated as a whole?
In general, we were treated as the doers. We are the ones that like made all of the centers run. It wasn't so much at the time, not until you got involved with Jeunesse or with like apparently DOS at the end, but there wasn't really the main delineation was with your rankings. So if you were, you know, a white sash, if you will, for those who don't know what the sashes are, they're sort of our levels in the program that have to do with how many people you've enrolled versus how many courses you've taken or how, you know, how much you've quote grown. But the white sashes would not have any expectations. The yellow sashes would start to be like housekeeping. You know, they would be required to come to the centers and keep things clean. You know, as it goes up and up and up, you get more intense in the feedback and intense in the manipulation and control.
Continuing the conversation on Proverbs after this short break.
I wanted to take a moment to talk about a new brand that I've been loving at the minute. And that brand is Ana Luisa Jewelry. Now, their pieces are all unique. They make you feel empowered and they serve as a perfect addition to any outfit, whether you're dressing up or down. They offer high quality at affordable prices and are carbon neutral from packaging to product, which we know is super important. Anyone that knows me knows that I love an accessory. I think jewelry is a great way to express yourself and to experiment with fashion as well. And of course, it is a great sentimental gift for a loved one too. They are giving Proverbs listeners 40% off when you buy another product on their website. Just go to shop.analuisa.com/Daisy or click the link in the description for a discount.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Was there a particular event made you think, you know what, this is, I want to get out of this, I want to leave? Was there a particular instance that made you realize everything and made you think, I want to get out of this?
Yes, absolutely. And this is one that didn't make it in the cut of the Seduced documentary. And I want this story to be heard because it's important. But there was, I was already being given really intense feedback and things were starting to be taken away from me. So that kind of wasn't great. And I was like, well, I had to actually go get a quote real job and start so that I could actually pay any of my bills and my debts and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I worked for a company while I was out there for about a year. But towards the end of that time working for this company, I was sitting in Saratoga Springs in a coffee shop. I think it's called Uncommon Grounds. And I was doing my work for my clients. I was a web developer. So I had about 32 clients that were active. So I was sitting down at the table with my list of clients so I could go through it with my a person that was working for me. And all of a sudden I looked up and one of the like Nexium Enemy bloggers, I don't know how to say his last name properly, but I say it as John Tai. He was standing about 10 feet away from me maybe and just staring at me for an extended period of time. He didn't do anything. He didn't say anything, but he stood there and he stared at me. It was very unnerving for me. I had told a few people about it and I had just a couple of people, my closer people I was closer with about it, but I wasn't intending on, you know, making any actions on it. All of a sudden I got a call from Claire Bronfman telling me that she had heard about the incident and asked if I could come down to her office or to some office. And when I did, there was a team of attorneys there and Claire Bronfman, and they had told me the story they heard, which was kind of accurate. And they said that they really would appreciate it if I would file some kind of a report or a request to have him arrested for harassment. I was floored. I was like, I don't think what he did was I didn't think what happened was to that level. There was a lot of coercive control and persuasion in that meeting. You'll be doing a really good thing for the whole entire organization if you do this, and just a lot of what they call like double binds and insisting that I make this move, you know. Mm-hmm. As I left that office, I didn't feel I had a choice in that sense. I felt like everything I'd ever worked for in the organization would have been taken away from me. I went in, I filed the report. I was so terrified. I became like almost sick with paranoia after that. They told me that there was something wrong about the report. I needed to add something else. So that made it even worse. I had to go back to the lawyers and explain that what they said. And then the lawyers rewrote a second draft. But in between the rewriting of the second draft and turning it in, I couldn't handle it anymore. Every time I left my front door, I was paranoid that this person really was going to come after me and hurt me, you know, even though like that person likely had no idea that I had done, you know, that I had done this. Yeah. And so, so finally I made the plan to leave, move totally out of state and get away. And the day of my leaving, I turned in the second draft and I left. It just was the pressure of it was too much for me. Now that was when I left the area. There was several more events that made me eventually leave the organization itself. But that's when I moved out of Albany.
And what happened when you left, Tabby? How were you treated? Did people that were still in the cult make contact with you? Were you aware of how you were being spoken of or the things that people were saying?
So that's an interesting question because I mostly lost all of my friends. I stayed in contact with Alice and Matt because I worked for her still. I stayed in contact with Nikki Klein because we were sort of closer acquaintances while I was there. And I just thought she was a cool person, you know? So I just kind of wrote her every now and then, was like, hey, how's it going? You know, I stayed in contact with a few other people, but it was always me reaching out to them. It was unless they needed work done for websites. It was never, you know, them reaching out to me. A few people would start to say that I was like betraying the organization and things like that. But overall, I tried to make it a very quiet exit where I didn't complain. I didn't, you know, eventually I made a resignation letter and I just didn't want to rock any boats whatsoever. But later I found out that it was being told to other people that I was what they call a suppressive person, even though I had tried to make a clean exit, that I was a bad person and I couldn't, you know, I shouldn't be talked to. So I found that there was like an actual effort to prevent people from talking to me, which when I first found that out, I remember feeling like, what, why? You know, like it was very strange. But then, you know, after all the trials and everything, I was like, oh, you know, it's kind of a badge of honor to be listed amongst the other suppressives of people who actually took the organization down. Not that I had a hand in that, but I just felt like, oh, I get to be part of that Hall of Fame. That's great.
How was integrating back into everyday life for you? Were there instances where you'd catch yourself, you know, doing things that you maybe weren't allowed to do inside Nexium, or thinking things, or finding out that the things that they taught you about the outside world were absolutely not true?
That is an excellent question, and it was terrible for me. I had been accustomed to sort of admitting my wrongdoings inside the organization. And so if I was called into an office at work or whatever, I would immediately admit any wrongdoings to kind of avoid further punishment. But then I had a boss at the time who thought it was really funny. And so they would like take those weaknesses that I had just admitted and then exploit them for fun, literal fun. Like he, for instance, I let him know that when you say, please come to my office and you don't tell me why, it's really terrifying for me, you know? Mm-hmm. And he would literally for fun say, I need you to come down to my office. And I had the reaction every time, even though I knew after a while that he thought it was funny. And so there was things like that where I didn't really know how to gauge myself back into a social experience. And like, what was it okay to actually say to people versus not okay to say to people? So I was often described as really weird and withdrawn and a person who's I was described as someone who doesn't like, in Nexium they call them non sequiturs, but a person who like doesn't follow through a conversation, you know? Mm-hmm. People would talk and then I would just randomly say something else, you know? And it just was very difficult for me. I lost all of my friends, my previous friends that I had before Nexium, I eventually lost. I had a very difficult time making new friends and even trusting people in a work environment. That was very hard.
Yeah, I've spoken to cult survivors before and people that have now escaped sort of abusive movements, and they speak a lot about their intuition and how their intuition is one of the first things that's sort of stripped out of them when they join a movement or when they join a cult, because, you know, by design, cults don't want you to question things. And I can't imagine how difficult it must be to, you know, integrate back into the outside world and to learn to trust people and to learn that people's intentions, as you said, especially in the workplace, are true. So yeah, that must have been so difficult for you. And I don't think people appreciate that it's almost like having to relearn things all over again, which must be a really, really scary, confusing, daunting process.
Yeah, well, I have a kind of a gap in between, you know, leaving, deciding to quit, and then realizing that it really was a cult, right? So there was, I decided to quit the whole thing around 2014, but it didn't come out that it was an actual cult until I think 2017. So it was a 3-year gap in which I had decided I was trusting everybody, right? I was like, okay, hey, everyone's great, you know? And during that time period, I had, you know, had gotten pregnant with my twin sons, and the job that I was at the time was the boss that I had at the time, we had hung out. Like I had taken care of that person's kids. I had, you know, I had been, I don't know, like we had bonded in a, you know, a way that it seemed very trusting to me, you know? Well, the next, I guess, performance evaluation after having my kids was all of my marks were great. Like outstanding or, you know, great, you know, but the person had decided to put like, I don't know, a whole novel of notes about every time that I had failed that person's expectations, you know? And it now it was in my record permanently. Like that person refused to remove anything, you know? And it was just a weird kind of random backstabbing thing that happened that kind of opened my eyes to wait, hold on. Something's not right here. You know? And so, that was also around the time that things started coming around Nexium. And from that point forward, my job there was just in jeopardy throughout the remaining time that I was there.
What was it like for you to see sort of that legal process unfold and to see the fall of Nexium, knowing that, you know, that was something that you were once a part of? Was that a strange experience for you?
It was shocking. Like, I literally felt like I had shell shock on most new developments. When Keith was arrested, I remember feeling like, oh, I felt like a sense of relief. But then seeing Allison, who I would say I was close to, she probably wouldn't, but seeing Allison there and, you know, how she looked in those images, I just felt like shell shocked. I just couldn't believe it, you know? And then that was even after seeing Sarah Edmondson, who I was friends with on the Times, on the cover of Times, right? So everything was just shocking as it unfolded. And I was watching the news like everyone else was watching the news. And I'm like, what is happening? You know, it was very scary for me. Like I said, I was left and right at this point, losing friends. I was told later at my work that people thought that I was trying to recruit them into a sex cult. And I had already been out of that group before that even began, you know. But it was just like, it was a really horrible time for me. It was so bad, in fact, that I had to leave work. I couldn't stay at work. I had to go on medical leave.
It was such a public story. It was shocking, you know, to see some of the revelations that came out on the news. It was shocking for the world to see, but I can't imagine what it must have been like for you to sort of watch as the events of the legal trial sort of unfolded and all of these revelations coming out, for you to see that, knowing that, you know, you were once a part of that reality. That must have been so difficult. How has your experiences helped you with the work that you do today? Because I know you're doing some incredible stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is the question, I think. And that's what's the important part for me, is it has fully shaped my future career path. I was a web developer. I was a software engineer. That is what my degree is in, computer science. And so after that, I had thought about, like, why did I join Nexium? Like, what was it really that I wanted at Nexium? And my answer was I wanted to feel loved and special by Allison. You know, I'm not going to lie about that. But also, I really wanted to help. I wanted to, like, help people realize their potential and become, you know, the person they wanted to become. And so, you know, I thought, like, what's the best way to do that, like, legitimately, you know, without going to a cult in that sense. So I actually went straight towards getting my master's degree in psychology, with an emphasis in marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. So now I actually provide therapy for clients who have experienced coercive control, or, you know, I provide therapy in general to people, but I try to specialize it in coercive control or in parenting, which is there is a link to coercive control, because our modern parenting is designed in a very coercive way. So my goal is just help people kind of lose that sense of that need to coerce people, you know, or that need to be coerced, if you will. But yeah, and then on top of that, as I was filming Seduced, by the way, it was like filming Seduced was great. It was a wonderful experience that was designed to kind of break down that process of recruitment and indoctrination. And so it was kind of cool to, like, hear how all the women had that experience. It's a scene that wasn't in the final cut, but we were with Yanya Lelich. And I remember asking, why are those loyalists still there? And it kind of came out that, like, some of them may just not have the resources they need to leave, which was the case with me, you know? So I'm like, well, why don't we create an organization that can help people do that, you know? And so, I mean, and I did. Like, the very next day I started on that process. I created a a business plan, and I eventually registered the business, and here I am working with the Freedom Train Project Incorporated. I've helped about, 15 different people in the last couple of months get resources they need to be able to either leave or to heal from their cult trauma. And my goal is to work with 2,000 people a year, and then, grow that out as time goes on. So yeah, Freedom Train is kind of my baby. And so it's something I'm so proud of, and it is directly born from that pain and that cult.
I think it's so amazing that you've used your pain and your trauma, which is, it's such a difficult thing that you've done, and it's so inspirational that you've used that for the greater good of other people, and your teaching experiences through your taught experiences, through your learned experiences. I think that's so important. I think, as I said at the start of this episode, I feel like it really takes a certain type of person to do that. But I also think that, sometimes working through your pain and trauma and using it to help other people is almost a form of therapy for yourself in itself, which is really interesting. What advice would you give to people, Tabby, that may be trying to escape a cult right now?
The biggest advice as the executive director of a victim services agency is, there is help out there. You have not lost everything. You are not alone. You have not lost everything. It feels like it. It feels like they've taken all your money, all your friends. It feels like they've taken your hope. But with the, getting the right, reaching out to the right people, the right agencies, they're there to help you and help you with transportation out, help you, building a new life, help you with clothes if you need it, with like anything. They're there for you as much as they can be. So you're not alone and you haven't lost everything. Just take that first step. That's what I would say to people.
And what are some signs of indoctrination that people should be aware of, that people should look out for?
I would certainly say let's say I'm a person outside of a cult. If I have a friend, for instance, who disappears for long periods of time, and then when they come back, the only thing they want to talk about is the person or group that they've disappeared off into, and that's all that they can focus on, I would say that's a pretty big red flag. If you question anything with them and they get aggressive in their response back, or if they cut you off, that's the second big red flag. That they're not allowed to actually question their indoctrination. And then if you are being groomed for indoctrination, that one I would just say, keep your ears open and listen to your friends. It's hard when you're being groomed to realize that you're being groomed. It really is, because everyone wants to feel loved and accepted. And a large part of the grooming process is that sort of love bombing process where people are making you feel loved and accepted. And so it's hard to, I don't ever want to say like, oh, if anyone's making you feel loved and accepted, then it's probably a cult, because that's not true, right? But if you have friends who are concerned or family members who are concerned, I would certainly say like, keep your ear out and be willing to question. And then if you start questioning, if there's any repercussions or punishments for questioning, then I would say that is a major red flag.
That's some really great advice and some really powerful advice as well, Tabby. And as you said, there are always people and places that you're able to reach out to that will fully support you on your journey, whatever stage you're at on this journey as well, which is, it's really important just to highlight once again. When we finalize every episode of the podcast with a life lesson, something that you live by or something that gets you up and going in the morning. So Tabby, I just want to finalize with this final question for you, which is, what is your mantra for life?
I would say the thing that gets me up is the word love. Love is what drives everything for me. It's what drives my own introspection, and it's what drives working with people. It's what drives, having children. It's important to recognize that love is more powerful than anything. It's very inspiring for me. So I do all of this with love.
Tabby Chapman, thank you so much for being here. You're hugely inspirational. Keep up this incredible work that you're doing, because it truly is making a difference. It's been amazing to chat to you today.
Thank you so much, Daisy. Thank you for letting me be here.
And that concludes this episode of Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. That is me. I hope you enjoyed it. Hit subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes, and I will see you soon.